I am Allison Jacobson. I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober continuously since the 18th of February of 2019. I have a sponsor and I have a home group, the Buckingham Group. And I'm really, really grateful to be here tonight. Thank you so much, Dale and the Hills and Sam, for having me and the whole group. You heard my husband last week, and we were laughing today. He said, please tell me you're not going to give any kind of rebuttal. And I would never do that. And you will find out why. I put that man through more than any person deserves to be through. And he is a real trooper. And gosh, we have been married coming up this upcoming year, March of 2024. We will have been married for 30 years. That's shocking. And thank my friend Helen for driving up here with me tonight. She drove us. And you would think, though, the discussion we had coming up in the car was rather dark. And I told her, I said, I don't know what I'm going to say tonight. And I hope it doesn't go to the dark side, but it might. So I will apologize in advance. There's some things going on that are just sad and hard, and I don't know if I'll get to talking about them or not, but they're just really uncomfortable. I called my sponsor today and I said, you know, I don't do death well at all. And she's like, well, none of us do. And unfortunately, the only thing I can tell you is that you get better at it with experience. And I thought, yuck. And but I will get into my story. Originally, I am from upstate New York. And I always used to joke and say, if I never set foot in upstate New York again, I will not care. It will be way too soon. And yet I did have to set foot in upstate New York again this past January. And I have the feeling I will be stepping foot in upstate New York a little bit more in the time in the future. My mom still lives there. She lives in Ithaca. But that's where I lived until I was 13. And that is where my first drink occurred. And I remember it like it was yesterday. You know, I'm 57, a little past 57 years old. And my first drink occurred when I was 13. And I remember what I was wearing that night. I was wearing a pair of Lee jeans and a pink shirt with stripes in it. It was my favorite outfit. And me and my friend Jennifer Bluestone, we had planned this little double date. And now I laugh because we thought we were so cool. And Al and I have a son who's going to be 15 in a couple of weeks. And I thought, if he told me he was going on a double date, I think I would laugh. And but we, you know, we thought we were really cool and really grown up. And we were going on this double date. And the plan was everybody was going to sort of take what they could from their home in the way of alcohol. And this was back in the 70s. You could make a fake ID and nobody cared. And I'm sure the lady at the Rite Aid where my friend Jennifer went in and bought, I think she bought 2 6-packs of Molson Golden. And the lady didn't blink an eye. Jennifer gave her fake ID and out she walked with the 2 6-packs of Molson Golden. And we're having a cookout by this railroad tracks and canal. And that night I had, I think it was 4 Molson Goldens, a flask of Burgundy and a flask of vodka. And for about, I know it sounds so gross. And I want to say for about like the first 30 or 40 minutes of that double date, I mean, I felt like amazing. I felt empowered. You know, I used to walk around feeling so inadequate and less than and kind of withdrawn and shy. And in this like 30 minutes or so, I felt better than you. I felt funny. I felt pretty. I just felt like I could take on the world. And there's a part in the doctor's opinion. I actually just went through it today, this morning, with a woman I'm working with. And it's one of my most favorite lines in the book. Men and women drink, essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And I always say, if I could change anything in that book, I would say it's because we loved the effect produced by alcohol. Mm-hmm. I felt just like Bill Wilson. I had arrived. shift. And it was just an amazing feeling until it wasn't. That evening, I ended up rolling around on the ground, vomiting, you know, crying and screaming about the state of my life. And, you know, at 13 years old, I don't know how bad it can be, but you know how dramatic teenagers are. And I, you know, was no exception. And so it happened that where we were, I'm just getting my seltzer water straight so I don't spill it. It happened to be where we were, this old railroad tracks and canal packed up into a, like at a, an apartment condominium complex, and people heard all the hullabaloo going on. And my friends didn't know what to do. The boy I liked, he sure didn't know what to do. And somebody called an ambulance. And back then, you know, I wasn't arrested, nothing like that. I was taken home in an ambulance, and we lived in a cul-de-sac. And so everybody saw the roar, roar of that ambulance light. And my aunt was visiting my mom that weekend. And I remember that night, my mom and my aunt just staying up with me while I got sick. And then I passed out, and I definitely blacked out, because I came to the next day and I knew vaguely I was in a lot of trouble, and I knew I probably had made a big fool out of myself, but I couldn't remember. I couldn't piece together all of the night. But the one thing I remembered was how I felt when I started drinking. And I thought to myself, not like, you know, my body hurt all over because I was rolling around. I didn't think, okay, I'm not drinking anymore. This was a bad experience. You know, that boy I liked so much, he wasn't speaking to me. My friend Jennifer Bluestone was like, "Do you know what you did last night?" And I was like, "No, clearly I don't." None of that fazed me. You know, I'm sure it did a little bit, but I was like, okay, if I can figure out how to drink and not throw up and not make a scene, I am in business, you know, and that was my thought. And so for the next several years, I pursued that. I didn't turn into a daily drinker then. I didn't turn into a morning drinker then. I turned into a, anytime we can steal it from our parents or somebody has a fake ID, that's the kind of drinker I turned into at that point. And every time I drank, things happened, you know, and they weren't good things. They were consequences. It was just, I alienated somebody. I lied to people. I was blacking out. At a very, you know, I blacked out almost every time I drank, and people didn't want to hang around me. And, you know, my mom was concerned. I grew up in an alcoholic home, although that does not make me alcoholic. Why I'm alcoholic is because I have an allergy and an obsession. You know, once I take one, I've got to have number two. It's going to follow closely thereafter number one. And that obsession is what Alcoholics Anonymous treats. You know, I will plot it. I will plan it. It's just, alcohol is my solution. And you all introduced me to another solution. So today, not only do I not have to drink, I don't want to drink. And we'll get into that. But so at this time, alcohol was my solution. You know, I wasn't getting along with my parents, my mom in particular. I lived with her. My parents were married to each other and divorced from each other twice while I was growing up. So I'll just put that out there. They got divorced the first time when I was in first grade. They got married again when I was in 10th grade. And my mom left my dad for the last time the day I left for college. So there you go. And so at different parts in the story, my parents are married, but at some parts they're not. And at this time, when I first started drinking, I was living with my mom. And I don't know when it happened, but I just hated my mother. You know, I didn't think she was nice. She has been on every single inventory I have ever written, maybe with the exception of one. And that might be one that where my sponsor said, "I want you to do an inventory about such and such." So I had a particular topic, but every other free floating one she's been on. And we didn't get along. You know, I didn't like her. She didn't like me. And she went to Ithaca one weekend. We were living in Rochester, and she went to Ithaca one weekend because that's where her sister lives. And actually, that's where my mom now lives. But she went to visit them. And I had the party planned before she was even out of the driveway. What I did not know was that my mom had asked the neighbors to check in and let her know if there was any suspicious activity. And I will tell you, there was a lot of suspicious activity at our home that evening. And She drove the 2 hours from Ithaca back to Rochester, and there was people in her bed. There was all kinds of outside issues going on in her home, and there was alcohol, of course, and then there was me. And I don't know how she got everybody out of there, but she did. And my mom had threatened so many times to send me to live with my dad. My brother was already living there because of his stuff. And my dad lived in Virginia, but that's how I landed in Virginia. And she told me that night, she said, you better pack your bag because tomorrow you're going to be on a plane and you're going to go live with your dad. I didn't believe her. I had no reason to believe her. It was like, okay, she's saying this for the 50,000th time. And I just kind of passed out and came to with her knocking on my door at like 6 in the morning, like, are you ready? Because you're going. And I mean, I was freaking out. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is my life. I've lived there all my life. Not anymore. And so I landed in Virginia when I started high school. And that's just a horrible time to move anywhere. Everybody's already got their friends and you're the outcast. And so I was. And by then I was smoking cigarettes and, you know, drinking when I could. And my dad picked me up from Dulles Airport and we lived in Reston. And my dad and I were real close and he was trying so hard and he gave me not a lecture, but trying to talk to me in a nice way. And he's like, listen, I know, you know, you got some bad habits going, Allison, and you've given up everything you liked. And I'll tell you, before I took a drink of alcohol, I was a straight A student. I was a captain of the cheerleaders, which that's embarrassing now, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was involved in sports and volleyball and basketball, and I had friends. The minute it seemed like alcohol took a hold, all that was gone. You know, I didn't care about school and cheerleading was stupid and sports were stupid and just all of it. I just couldn't be bothered with it. And I had tunnel vision because this was my solution and this is how I was going to do life. You know, I needed it. And so, my dad at the time was sober. You know, I told you I come from an alcoholic home and it's weird. Both my brother and I are adopted and I don't know if I won the alcoholic lottery, but I was adopted into an alcoholic home and I come from biologically a very long line of alcoholics. It is no shock that I'm alcoholic. And, my dad was sober at the time. He was going to drink again and then get sober again. But at this time he was sober and he used to smoke Camel cigarettes and he'd keep his carton on the top of the fridge. And I thought I was so slick because I told her I smoked cigarettes. So I had to feed at least one of my habits. And there wasn't much alcohol in the house because he was sober. And I would take a pack of these Camel 100s and I'd arrange the carton so it looked like you couldn't see a pack was missing. Well, my dad kept count. And, you know, and I did too. When I smoked cigarettes, I knew exactly how much I had. And when I drank, I knew exactly how much I had. And it's like, if anything went missing, I was going to know. I couldn't tell you what I did when I was drinking, but I could tell you how much I had. And so, you know, that was my high school life. Water seeks its own level. It was not long before I got in with the drinkers and the partiers and just sort of picked up where I left off. You know, I just, wherever I go, there I am. And I think my parents were trying to help me with a geographical, but it didn't work because I didn't want to change. You know, I just didn't. And when I was in high school, a couple things of note happened. I got in a really bad car accident with one of these friends that I had made, and we were at a green alcohol party. And I think I was a junior. I think it was 1983. And she had a little Honda Civic, I think. It was like a hatchback. And I don't even know how fast we were going, but we hit the telephone pole head on when we left that green alcohol party. It was in February and it was snowing. And I don't remember the accident at all. I remember coming to in the urgent care and they were squeezing glass out of my head. And fortunately, me and my friend, her name was Jennifer also. I seek out people named Jennifer. They seem to be good partiers. And and anyhow, neither one of us were seriously injured. And neither one of us was wearing a seatbelt and, you know, just on and on. And now, having a child, I look at this so differently because my parents were remarried at the time. They got a call well past midnight. Your daughter's in the hospital. She's been in a car accident. You need to come. They didn't know if I was alive. Nothing. And now I get choked up because I think we have our son and he's, you know, we're teaching him how to drive. And oh, I dread it. I just dread it. I wish he just could skip this part of life and not drive at all and ride a bike. And and I was so arrogant to my parents that night. My dad, oh man, he barely had anything to say. He drove by. My dad was very dramatic. I think I have turned into my dad when it comes to our son. He's famous for the 2-hour lecture. You do not leave that kitchen table until you agree with him. And I don't know why. I'm stubborn. I can't agree with him. I'm going to just keep arguing just because that's who I am. He drove me by the telephone pole. Then they drove us by the car. The car got taken to the high school to make an example of what happens when you're driving drunk. And this was at the time when Mothers Against Drunk Driving were just coming in to play. And I think if they had been more in play, we would have been in a lot of trouble. But we weren't. We got sentenced to one AA meeting. And Jennifer and I went to this one AA meeting and we thought it was the biggest joke we'd ever seen. And it was probably people younger than I am now. And we thought they were so old. And we were just like, oh my God. And I remember thinking, you know, maybe one day, if I still have a problem with drinking, after I'm married and have some kids or whatever, maybe I'll come here, you know, maybe. And boy, I didn't know what was down the road ahead of me. And so that's what I thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll fast forward. I got accepted to one college. I went there for a year and I dropped out because it got involved with my drinking. And I did stuff there. I remember going thinking it was a fresh start. And I don't know about any of you, but this, from my experiences, is that I continuously had to lower the bar. I used to say to myself, I never told myself I was going to stop drinking. What I told myself is if X, Y, or Z happened, I might have to look at it, or I might slow down, or I might do this, or I might do that. And I just had to keep lowering the bar. It's like, well, that wasn't so bad. You know, X, Y, and Z would happen, and I'm still drinking. And I did stuff at that college that I am not proud of. I couldn't even show up in the dining hall. And I thought, okay, I just can't go back there anymore. You know, it never mind. It never occurred to me to look at myself and say, okay, you know, there's something going on here. This is a real problem. Nobody was talking to me. I had become, before I put a drink in my body, I definitely had honed the art of lying. I had honed the art of stealing. I don't need alcohol to do those things. But when I have alcohol in my system, those things become very magnified. And I had a lot of wreckage when I landed here the first time and actually the second time too. And so anyway, I moved back in with my dad. He was drinking again at this time. So I thought this was great because I could drink as much as I wanted and my dad wouldn't care. And I just went from job to job, college to college. I finally just said, forget college. I don't care about college anymore. And I'm just going to work. And so I was basically just working to drink until my dad told me I couldn't live with him anymore. And I had to get out on my own. And that just escalated things because I couldn't afford that. I had to drink and I was bouncing checks. And there was never a time except the first month I moved into an apartment in the Northern Virginia area that everything was turned on and paid for at once. And then after that first month, it was a crapshoot because I would drink away my car payment. I would drink away my rent. I would bounce a check. I would just do whatever it took. I got myself into a mountain load of credit card debt. As a matter of fact, when I got sober the first time, I didn't even know how many credit cards I had run in. I had to really call the credit agency and find out. I mean, it's a little embarrassing, but it's true. And I had gotten myself to where I couldn't answer my phone. I couldn't get my mail. And I don't know what I thought that would solve, because it wasn't solving anything, but it just, I couldn't face it. I knew I was digging the hole and I didn't know how to get out. And by then, you know, my family, they're really talking to me about my drinking now. And my godmother happened to call me and she said, I've been through 4 treatment centers. I can't tell you how many detoxes. And the first time I went to treatment, my Aunt Linda called me and she called me at like 4:30 or 5 in the morning. And she said, I'm calling you at this time because I think maybe you won't be drinking yet. And I was. And not heavily yet, but I still had a few in me. So I listened to her because I was like, oh, geez. And she's like, you know, you're dying. And I was really in my early 20s. And she's like, we are so concerned about you. We love you so much. And I know how many of us in this room have heard this. You know, you have so much potential. And if you would stop drinking. Oh my gosh, I've heard that a million times. And so the first round of treatment, I really just went because I thought if I don't go, nobody in my family and my relatives, all my extended family, they're not going to talk to me and I can't have that. And so that started all that, you know, I build everybody's hopes up. And then phew, the first time I left treatment, I was drunk within 2 hours. And I'm not saying that to brag. It's just, I wasn't ready. I did not want to stop drinking. And I didn't understand the nature of my illness at that point. Cause I remember sitting in that treatment center thinking, well, if I can't drink anymore, I wonder if I could smoke some non-habit forming marijuana, but I never did that stuff. I'm a pure alcoholic. But I was willing to maybe try, you know, anything to get that effect. I just didn't want to be who I was at all. I hated myself. One night, what I used to do, this was back before the days of cell phones, and I would play what I call drunk and dial. I would get really drunk because by then I didn't have any friends. I wasn't dating anybody. I lived in a cockroach infested apartment that I couldn't afford. And I'd start drinking the 12 packs of like old Milwaukee's Best, I think, light. And it was like $3.95 a 12 pack. And if you can believe it, I would have to bounce a check to afford that. That is so, that's alcoholism. And so anyway, I would get really drunk, get really lonely because you can only watch TV so much. And I would call people drunk and I'd call my family and they always knew it was me. And this one night I called my brother and I think it's, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. I can't see this stuff when I'm in it, but it's, you know, God, I never disbelieved in God, but I never had a relationship with God. Obviously I did not have a good one when I was drinking. But even then, I can look back and see where God was working in my life and setting things up for me, because this call to my brother was pivotal. I called Stephen and I told him I wanted to kill myself. And I will back up and tell you, you know, I think at times I really did feel like dying. I was never going to do that. Obviously, I'm standing here today. And so I told him I wanted to kill myself because I needed him to stay on the phone with me and pay attention to me. And usually if you drop a bomb like that, people are. And so, but what happened next was it changed the whole course of my life. He said, you know, Allison, he worked at this place, this wilderness school at the time in Cumberland, Maryland. And he said, you know, Allison, my boss is in AA. He's been in AA for a couple of years and he's going to this Joe and Charlie thing this weekend. And would you go if he could get you in? I thought I was going to die. And I was just like, you have got to be kidding me. And this is not the conversation I wanted to have. But when you're calling somebody and you tell them you're going to kill yourself and they're offering a solution to you, you've got to at least pretend to be interested. And so I said, and I'm not kidding. This is how I thought. I was so selfish and self-centered. And I said, well, I think I can go Saturday. I don't know about Friday because, you know, I still had to get drunk Friday. But for whatever reason, I got in my little car and I drove to Frostburg, Maryland that weekend, Saturday. I got up early Saturday. I was probably so hungover. And I drove to Frostburg, Maryland, which was just a few hours away. And that's how I met who is now my husband, Dale. And I did not like him when I met him. And he was one of these, he was like 3 or 4 years sober at the time. And he was he's much the same way he is today. He has always, always had a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he doesn't do it so much now, but he had at the time, he would say these acronyms and he would laugh about it. And I can still hear it in my head. He'd say, "Allison, you know what the steps mean?" And I'd say, "No, probably really hungover." And he'd say, "Solution to every problem sober. Ooh, 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 ooh. You know what nuts is? Not using the steps." And he just loved these things. And he was on fire. And he was giving me, back then it was these AA cassette tapes. And he's like, "Here, listen to this on the way home. And here, take this and take this." I'm like, "What is this? And who are you?" And it, but you know, it planted a seed. I am going to take a sip of this one. It planted a seed because I was introduced to a program of action that weekend that I did not know existed. I told you I've been through 4 treatment centers and 1,000,001 detoxes. And I had to get my big book from one of these treatment centers out of a box in my little efficiency apartment. I hadn't cracked it. I hadn't read it. I might have looked at the stories when I was drunk. It meant nothing to me. I did not know what a gold mine of, you know, our life's line is in that book. And I didn't know it because I didn't care. But that weekend, I listened to Joe and Charlie. And as hungover as I was, you know, I was like, "Oh my gosh, there are things to do here. There are actual things to do." Because what would happen to me in all these times of trying to get sober, and I go in these fits and starts. And I think you probably heard it at meetings, you know, we can stop anytime, any day, anywhere. The problem I have is I cannot stay stopped. I suffer from a spiritual problem. I am disconnected from you. I'm disconnected from any kind of God of my understanding or misunderstanding. And unless I tap into this by taking the steps, I'm going to be cut off from that. And so Joe and Charlie, you know, all they're passed on. First, the first Joe passed away, and then they had the second Joe, and then he passed away, and Charlie Parmley passed away. And now, you know, we have them archived on tapes and CDs and stuff, but I think, oh my gosh, I get chills. I got to see them in person twice. And they went through line by line how to take these steps, you know? And I look at the first step, and in We Agnostics, it says, if when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. I looked at those words. I thought, holy crow, I answer affirmative to both. It's not an if or, you know, it's both, hands down. There are honestly times when I wanted to stop and I could not. And I'm sure everybody can think of something in their head when they really, they wanted to stop and they couldn't. And definitely once alcohol is in my system, I am off to the races. Nobody can fix me. I can't fix me. The psychic hotline can't fix me because I called them and actually in all earnestness was praying that they had a solution for me. Nobody can fix me. My family can't fix me. Other loved ones can't fix me. And I sure can't fix me because if I could have, I would have a long time ago. And so anyway, I'll fast forward, and June 5th in 1993 was the first time I got sober. And I got sober and I got on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And Al and I were dating, we got married, and his sponsor at the time was a taper. We got to help him tape and go to conventions for free, which was great because we had no money. And I mean, we spent probably the first several years of our married life, like in conventions of Alcoholics Anonymous, almost every weekend. And I mean, it was thrilling. I've seen people who are no longer with us, and I can still remember what they said. And I feel so, I guess, blessed that I got to be there for that. And you know, I was thinking when I was walking today, my husband during COVID made a big trail all around our property, and I do laps around it. It's when I do my best thinking, and I'll think about some of those guys who are no longer with us, and I'll think about what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I've seen happen to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 21 years, which by my standards anyway, was that was a long time to be continuously sober without anything, sober from the neck up. And I took a drink, and that doesn't happen overnight. It just doesn't. And, you know, nobody gets struck drunk. I remember one of my old sponsors, she would say, if somebody had an affair or something, she'd say, okay, you know, tell me the truth, because I know this just didn't happen. You just didn't end up in bed with that person. Well, nobody ends up just taking a drink for no reason at all. And, you know, the longer I stayed sober, the more arrogant I got. And I, you know, I had to have this little life, and it had to look a certain way. And I had everything I wanted, everything. And I was sponsoring all these women who I had good, solid, close relationships with. And boy, I had arrived. You know, it's just like when you're drinking and you feel you can arrive, you can feel that way in sobriety. And what I said earlier, I suffer from a spiritual illness. And if I don't treat that every day in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get sicker sober than when I'm with a drink, you know, when I take a drink. And I can get away from the God of my understanding, and I can start thinking that I'm in charge, and I can start living in ways that aren't conducive to me staying sober. You know, we have a friend right now who's going through a very, very difficult time. And I'm still so selfish and self-centered. I said to somebody, I said, how can these people do these things and stay sober? And I didn't. And it's like, I was laughing when I said that, but I don't think that way anymore. You know, when I was on my walk today, I knew I was coming here tonight. And this meeting has a lot of a special meaning to me. And that's probably why I was so nervous. It's a lot easier to talk to people I don't know than to talk to people I have a rich history with. But these are the best things for me to do. And just had a brain fart. I told you I'm 57 years old. I lost my own track of thought, my own train of thought. And I thought, more than most, the alcoholic leads a double life. That's in our literature. And I had plenty of opportunity to talk to people, to tell them what's going on, to level my pride. And I didn't. And that's on me. And I'll tell you what, my sponsor now, today, I probably drive her crazy. She's probably like, why is she calling me yet again? Because I know what happens when I don't. And I know what happens when I don't tell the truth. And I don't want to live that way ever again. When I picked up a drink, I had my husband, obviously, and we had our son, and he was 5 or 6. I've got to do the math. But anyway, he was young. He was, I think, just out of kindergarten, maybe right in between kindergarten and first grade. And it was just awful. You know, my son, when he was born, he had 2 sober parents. He could depend on us for anything and everything. I was the mom who I took him to every birthday party. I went to every school event. And then fast forward a couple of years, alcohol's got a hold of me. And when my son started 5th grade, it was a big deal at the school he went to, because that was the year the kids got lockers. And my son, I can't even tell this story without losing it. My son was the one kid who was so excited about getting a locker. I remember the day 4th grade was over, we had to order on Amazon all this stuff for him to decorate his locker. Helen shaking her head, telling me to watch our son. And she knew this story. And Jake, oh my gosh, now I'm laughing. He bought a little rug for that locker. He bought a chandelier. Oh, he bought some stuff for that locker. He was so proud of that. And the deal was, the tradition is all the fifth graders come with their parents and they decorate their locker. And I was drunk in a hotel in Farmville and I didn't make it. And my son didn't know where I was. My husband didn't know where I was because I wasn't answering my phone. And my son called Helen and he knew she went to a meeting in Farmville and he said, "Can you please look for my mom's car?" That's a horrible, horrible thing. And when I think about it, that's not the life I wanted for my son, you know? But that's where alcoholism took me, and it took me down further. And I don't need to get into all of that. I think you got a good, I put my family through the ringer. I put my friends through the ringer. Anybody who was attached to my life, I blew them out of the water. And for about the first year of my sobriety, I don't know if I saw it as clearly as I see it today. You know, I don't know if I could. When we drink, we don't just hurt ourselves. We hurt anybody who's in a million mile radius of us. And we let people down. And it talks about it, you know, it talks about hurt feelings. It talks about broken relationships. It just, oh my gosh. Fierce resentment. And I had a lot of wreckage. And that first year of my sobriety, I didn't know if I was going to make it. I don't think anybody knew. And I mean, when I finally landed, I didn't know I was landing for good. My liver hurt, everything hurt. And, you know, I've got some health issues now that I think are a direct result of that 5 years of drinking and that I'm trying to rectify. And so I remember pulling into my driveway, and I had tried so many times since getting drunk, trying to sober up and fits and starts. And I put together a few months. At one time, I put together a whole year and getting sponsors and thinking this was going to be it. And I remember when I first started drinking again, thinking, well, if it gets really bad, I know what to do. All of a sudden, I couldn't stop. That obsession was on me. Fiercer than I ever remember it in my late 20s, because the first time I got sober, I was 27 years old, and I just don't remember it being the way it was 4.5 years ago. And it was scary. And I remember pulling into my driveway, and I thought, okay, this is just crazy town. And I thought, well, all right. And I don't know why I talk to myself like this and why I remember it even, but it's such a job crazy I am. And I pulled into my driveway and I said out loud to myself, okay, I am going to really try Alcoholics Anonymous and really try what a sponsor tells me to do. And if I can't stay sober for 6 months, heck with it. I don't know what I had planned on doing. I'm sure it was something dramatic, like move, you know, or I don't know what it was. And so it was weird though. It was like, I don't know if I'm going to say I felt relieved, because I had a lot of wreckage out there. But it was like an exhale. And it was like, okay, I finally have just made a commitment to something. And little by slow, day one ended, you know, then day two, the days add up to weeks, the weeks add up to months. And I don't think anybody in my family trusted me until maybe I was about 3-ish years sober. And I, you know, I'll tell you what, this past summer, Al and Jake went to Florida for a week and I couldn't go. It was something we had planned to go a certain week. And then because of something his brother had to do, they had to go, they had to move it a week. And I just couldn't go because of work. And nobody in my family batted an eye. It's just like, okay, well, do you have stuff to do? Are you gonna, you know, you're gonna be okay? And I can assure you, even 2 years ago, my husband would have paid somebody to come in the home and stay with me to make sure that I didn't take a drink. And even then, I don't know if it would have worked, you know? And because he used to do that. Well, maybe if you just have somebody sit with you, you'll be okay. And I would like go into my closet and drink. So I don't know. But when they left for Florida, it hit me. And I thought, oh my God, they left for Florida and they left me in this house. And I like super cleaned the house. Oh my God, I I like streamed all this stuff on TV that I've been wanting to watch. And I mean, it was glorious for everybody. But there's a long road of reconstruction ahead. And it's really only been in the last couple of years where I feel as though my marriage is beginning to fall more into place. You know, I thought I had shot that forever. At one point I thought, well, okay, I guess we're going to just stay together until our son graduates from high school and then maybe go our separate ways. And that just broke my heart. And because we have a very rich history together. And I hated it. And I hated it because I knew it was because of decisions I had made. And I just thought, and my sponsor told me, you have got to stay in your lane. You have got to worry about staying sober one day at a time. You have got to start recreating your life that the doctor's opinion talks about. I had to have that entire psychic change so I could recreate my life. And you know, so I started doing that. And I'm not going to say I didn't worry about what was going to happen or anything like that, but I needed to get out of the way of everything. And if I'm in there trying to mix it and manage it, God can't come in and do what he needs to do, you know, because Allison Jacobson's in the way. And my son, he was quicker to come around. Jake and I have always had a very, very close relationship. But about the first year of my sobriety, I could not get gas or go to the grocery store unattended. Somebody in my family was going with me. And I just thought, you have got to be kidding me. It's amazing how the ego rebuilds. You know, I can go blow up my life and the lives of other people. And then 2 months wonder, okay, why is everybody still mad at me? You know, why are they mad at me? And why don't they trust me? And oh gosh, I like to make phone calls in my car, and I couldn't make any phone calls in my car. I couldn't catch up with anybody. And my sponsor told me, well, really? So if the shoe were on the other foot, you know, how would you be feeling? And I thought, I don't like you either, sponsor. And she reels me in, you know, but it's only because I'm willing to tell her what a jerk I really am. I tell her what I'm thinking. You know, we don't get in trouble for what we think. We get in trouble for what we do. But I've got to be honest with somebody about what I'm thinking. Because if I think it long enough, I start acting on it. And that's just always been my MO. You know, I can't let any little weird thing take hold in this brain of mine because I make a mess of things. I really, really do. And I'll fast forward to today. It's definitely... My husband said it at a meeting yesterday. I really, really like it. He said, if you want to get a glimpse of what a perfect family is, look next door. You know, it's definitely not us. However, I will say that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of the steps, because of the traditions, and because of the willingness to recreate this relationship with the God of my misunderstanding, everybody in the Jacobson household gets a second shot. And I love that. I love that. I thank God for it every day because I know it shouldn't be this way. You know, there was a woman I used to sponsor. She came to my baby shower and she drank herself to death. She drank herself to death when I was like 2 years sober. And it didn't nearly kill me, but I just thought, oh, you know, and then just recently, another woman who just couldn't get sober drank herself to death, you know, and I know that could have been me. I told you, I came in here, my liver hurt. I'm having to have some colon surgery on Tuesday that I'm convinced is a direct result of drinking for those 5 years. And you know, it's okay because as Billy Hill said, when we came in, you know, we're on this side of the dirt and I'm real grateful to be on this side of the dirt. One of my oldest friends of Alcoholics Anonymous is dying of cancer. You know, she's 30 years sober and she just had a bone scan the other day and the cancer's all over her body. That's when I called my sponsor today. I don't know what to say. We had a conversation yesterday. You know, she went through cancer before and we were all felt bad for her, but we just knew she was going to be okay. And it's a different conversation And I now, and we were talking yesterday, and it was very clear that she was talking with the knowledge that she's not going to be here much longer. And I just, I don't even know what to say about it. And it's my first friend I think that I'm going to lose. And we have a history together, you know, we just have a big, big history together. And so I call my sponsor, and my sponsor's really funny. Thank God, because, you know, obviously I'm a crier. And I called her and I said, I just suck at death. Sorry for that word. And I do, you know, I don't like it. It makes me very, very uncomfortable. I had a sponsor die in sobriety, but she went real quick. Nobody knew it was going to happen. She had a stroke. She was on life support for a week. They took her off the life support. She was gone. My father died in 2006. He went in for a surgery. They cut a main artery. He never came out of the surgery. He was gone. And not that those two things didn't affect me, because they did. They affected me deeply. But I just, gosh, this is uncomfortable. And I said to my sponsor, I said, I know this isn't about me, and I know I need to grow with this. And she said, well, we're going to grow with it one day at a time. And you're going to learn how to be a good friend to somebody who needs you. And I thought, okay. And it's another learning experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, if I'm sitting there with my husband called it my rock gut boxed wine, I would miss it. I would absolutely miss it. And I'm not happy about what's happening to my friend, but I will tell you, I am extremely grateful that God saw fit to keep me here so I can go through this experience with her. And I just, that's one of those things you just wouldn't forgive yourself if you're not there. And so it's not that life doesn't happen when we get sober, because obviously it does. People die, things happen, we lose jobs, we lose homes, we lose pets, all kinds of stuff. But we can get through it one day at a time if we are willing to do the work. You know, our son Jake has some challenges, and I'm not going to get up here and talk about him because that's his stuff. And sometimes they're difficult. You know, sometimes I want to lock myself in my room and just go back to being single, Allison. You know, I didn't sign up for all this. And it's like, but yes, I did. Yes, I did. And because of my network, because of my sponsor, because of my husband's grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have friends who are grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can exhale. And then I can be the best version of myself that I need to be for the people around me. And that's really what I think my alcoholism robbed people of. I was not the best version of myself, nor did I give a rip about being that. And today I want to be. You know, when I was talking to my sponsor about how uncomfortable I am with death, she said, you know, she said, I think because of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're charged with, if we are able, we must get up every day and see what we can pack into the stream of life. And we need to see how we can be the best version of ourselves to whoever needs it right then. And she said, if you are able, you must. And that keeps going through my mind. And because there are some days where I'm thinking, well, who's going to be the best version of themselves for me? Because that's what I'm looking for. But that's not what this is about. It's about, if I am able, I need to get up, suit up, show up, and I need to be the best version of myself for whoever needs me to be. And thank you so much for having me tonight.